Friday, June 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a deadly shooting at a U.S. church.
We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun.
Also ahead, the Greek financial bailout plus the Pope on climate change. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Hundreds of people attended a prayer vigil on Thursday at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in the U.S. city of Charleston, South Carolina, for the victims of the shooting that took place in the historic African-American church the night before. In the church's choir, it was a night before that a man who joined a prayer meeting inside Emmanuel AME Church then fatally shot 9 people, including the pastor, put up no resistance. He was arrested on Thursday. 21-year-old Dylan Storm Roth spent nearly an hour inside the church Wednesday night before killing 6 women and 3 men, then tried to outrun an all-night manhunt before a citizen in an adjoining state, North Carolina, spotted his car and tipped off police. Thursday afternoon, President Obama spoke at the White House saying he and Vice President Biden had been in touch with many of the people in Charleston. He also spoke of a personal connection with the people of Emmanuel Church.
Michelle and I know several members of Emmanuel AME Church. We knew their pastor, Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who, along with 8 others, gathered in prayer and fellowship and was murdered last night. And to say our thoughts and prayers are with them and their families and their community doesn't say enough to convey the heartache and the sadness and the anger that we feel. Any death of this sort is a tragedy. Any shooting involving multiple victims is a tragedy. There is something particularly heartbreaking about a death happening in a place in which we seek solace and we seek peace, in a place of worship. Mother Emmanuel is, in fact, more than a church. This is a place of worship that was founded by African Americans seeking liberty. This is a church that was burned to the ground because its worshipers worked to end slavery. When there were laws banning all black church gatherings, they conducted services in secret. When there was a nonviolent movement to bring our country closer in line with our highest ideals, some of our brightest leaders spoke and led marches from this church's steps. This is a sacred place in the history of Charleston and in the history of America. The FBI is now on the scene with local police, and more of the Bureau's best are on the way to join them. The Attorney General has announced plans for the FBI to open a hate crime investigation. We understand that the suspect is in custody, and I'll let the best of law enforcement do its work to make sure that justice is served. Until the investigation is complete, I'm necessarily constrained in terms of talking about the details of the case. But I don't need to be constrained about the emotions that tragedies like this raise. I've had to make statements like this too many times. Communities like this have had to endure tragedies like this too many times. We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Now is the time for mourning and for healing. But let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it. I say that recognizing the politics in this town foreclose a lot of those avenues right now. But it'd be wrong for us not to acknowledge it. And at some point, it's going to be important for the American people to come to grips with it and for us to be able to shift how we think about the issue of gun violence collectively.
President Obama speaking Thursday at the White House. My colleague Jim Stevenson spoke with Rashad Robinson. He is Executive Director of Color of Change, the largest online civil rights organization in the U.S. Robinson said the people of Charleston, and the nation for that matter, are simply looking for a path forward.
I think more than ever, particularly for members of Color of Change and for the larger African-American community and allies, we've been seeing sort of the impact and effect of racism not being dealt with in this country over the last several months, not to mention years and decades. And I think now it is more important than ever to intensify our efforts to transform the policies and practices, institutions and cultures that fuel this type of anti-Black racism. And our members and so many others are standing willing and ready to do that while also, I think, in a lot of pain over what they've seen.
And what are some of the ways that your organization might help accomplish that goal in pushing forward the discussion on this?
Well, a number of things that Color of Change has been working on for years is reform to our gun laws in this country. The fact that we can so easily get guns in this country, in America, and people can then act out sort of their vigilante aspirations, and that sort of leads to longer-term impact. The fact that on a level around this country, we don't have sort of the type of comprehensive hate crimes laws in many states that we need, in particular in South Carolina. South Carolina is a state that still flies the Confederate flag, a vestige of racism and hate in this country. And we still have a media climate, and this is one of the things that Color of Change continues to work on, sort of dealing with what we call implicit bias, the sort of bias that fuels a lot of the destruction that we see in our community or the inequality. We're working a lot holding media accountable, leveraging our members' voices and giving them in these moments something to do to hold media accountable for the stories that they're telling about our community. From the policy perspective to the cultural change necessary, there's a lot of work that has to happen in America, a lot of work that has to happen across communities. And while Black communities will be critical to this, it's going to take all Americans realizing that we've got to solve these problems to ensure that our democracy works for all of us.
That's Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change. It is the largest online civil rights organization in the U.S. He was speaking with VOA's Jim Stevenson. Well, the massacre at that Charleston church was a huge topic of discussion on Twitter on Thursday. VOA's Michael Lippin is here with more. What do you have for us, Michael?
Thanks, Steve. Yes, the Topsy analytics site shows that the hashtag Charleston shooting, that's all one word, has been used more than 850,000 times in the 24 hours since the incident. You know, that equates to an average of about 10 tweets per second, and it's a high level of Twitter activity for any hashtag. The hashtag Charleston shooting also was one of the top trending items on Twitter worldwide as well as in the U.S. But another hashtag has started getting a lot of attention, and that's hashtag Dylan Ruff, the name of the alleged shooter, with two N's in the Dylan. It was the number two trending topic on Twitter in the U.S. late Thursday. The social media spotlight on the shooter obviously resulted from him being identified and apprehended. Some people using that hashtag have been making the point that Dylan Ruff should be labeled a terrorist. They were also unhappy to see images of police escorting a calm-looking Ruff into and out of a courthouse in North Carolina where he was apprehended. Those Twitter users argued that Black suspects wanted by police get much rougher treatment. Of course, every case is different, and in this case, we know that Ruff did surrender to police without a fight.
You know, Michael, I've heard that condolence messages have been pouring in through social media. What have the people been saying?
Well, you know, that's one positive aspect to this terrible event. The huge volume of messages of sympathy for the victims shows that many people actually care. One place they've been leaving those messages is the Facebook page of the church targeted in the shooting. Its full Facebook name is Mother Emmanuel AME Church. A new message is being posted there about every minute, and here are some examples that I saw. From user Father Todd Boyce: "Dear brothers and sisters, you are in my prayers and in the prayers of Saints Mary and Martha Anglican Church in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. May God grant you peace and comfort, resolve and abiding faith during this incredibly difficult time. We love you." And here's another one from user Kathy Trapnell in New Bern, North Carolina: "So very sorry for the tragedy that occurred last night in your church. My prayers are with all the congregation and families of those killed in this horrific injustice." So if our listeners would like to send their condolences to the community in South Carolina, that's one place where they can go online. You can also, of course, go to the main article about the shooting on our website, voanews.com. And that's where we find this message from our reader, Kerfala, from Liberia. He wrote, "This terrorist white killer in the historic black church in Charleston has the same exact crime degree as the Islamic State and the killers in the recent attack on the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, and even as Osama bin Laden. The reason they are all the same is that their dream is to take the life of innocent civilians." Steve?
Many thanks, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. Just to reiterate Michael's point, check out our website for the latest on the Charleston shooting. Again, we're at voanews.com. This is VOA.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto:
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Creditors demanded Thursday that Greece propose economic reforms that could break the impasse in bailout talks. Greece was unequivocally denied any possibility for a delay or a grace period to repay the International Monetary Fund, as finance ministers from the Eurozones and the heads of the IMF and European Central Bank prepare for a much-anticipated crisis meeting in Luxembourg. Christine Lagarde is head of the IMF.
"In each and every review that we have done of Greece for the last 5 years, we have always showed flexibility. It's never been exactly the same as what was expected under the review. And we will continue to operate on that basis. But for that, any program has to answer four key principles. One, there has to be sustainability of the debt. Two, there has to be deliverability of the measures. Three, there has to be financing of the program. And fourth, flexibility by the institutions, accepting substitutability of measures. Now, clearly, the less the adjustment, the more the financing. Everything is about give and take. We are waiting, and we hope that the next few days will be used by the Greek authorities to come back with tangible, deliverable measures so that we can determine whether those four important criteria for programs to be credible and for us to be accountable to the international community can be satisfied."
Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis:
"We are dangerously close to a state of mind that accepts an accident. And I urge my colleagues not to fall prey to this state of mind. We can forge a good agreement. Our government is standing by with ideas and with the determination to cultivate the two forms of trust necessary to end this Greek drama. The trust of our partners and institutions in our government and in our society, and the trust of our people, both in our government and in Europe's capacity to produce policies that work for Europe as a whole and which end the crisis.
Eurozone President Yaron Dijsselbloem said Greece has to take further steps, in his word, to obtain a lasting deal that needs to hold up in the coming years to be credible, he says. A meeting of finance ministers of the 19 Eurozone countries planned for next week is crucial in determining whether international creditors would unlock another $8.2 billion in bailout funding ahead of a June 30th deadline by which Greece has to repay $1.8 billion to the IMF. Pope Francis's newly issued encyclical on the environment defines climate change as a moral issue that demands urgent action to resolve economic inequality and ecological devastation. VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports on what's in that document, which may run into some opposition from American conservatives.
Typhoon Haiyan was the deadliest ever to strike land. On a trip to the Philippines to visit survivors, the Pope told reporters what the encyclical puts in print.
I don't know if it's all man's fault, but the majority is. For the most part, it is man who continuously slaps down nature.
Scientists say that extreme weather events like Haiyan are made worse in a warmer world. The encyclical embraces the science of global warming as a moral imperative that builds on church teaching, says John Gehring, Catholic Program Director at Faith in Public Life, an advocacy group.
The church approaches this very much from a biblical point of view, the gift of creation. We're called to be good stewards of the environment. And so the Pope looks out at a world and sees that we have a broken relationship with the environment. And he says we need to repair this relationship.
The encyclical says the link between ecological devastation and rising inequality is undeniable. It says, quote, "The earth, our home, is beginning to look like an immense pile of filth." The Pope is using the document as an urgent call to action, Gehring says.
And my hope is a pope who has a global pulpit, who's the most compelling moral leader in the world, can help rise above some of the partisanship and the bickering around this issue and lead us to a better place.
That partisanship is reflected in the United States largely among conservative Republicans in Congress and some Republican presidential candidates who say the Pope has no business in politics. But those views are not shared by a majority of American Catholics, according to a recent survey. The Pope's social agenda broadens the Catholic narrative to include the environment as a pro-life issue. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon eagerly awaited the encyclical. At a Vatican climate change conference in April, Ban said religion and science were aligned in emphasizing the need for global action.
There is a very small window of opportunity which we can change this course. I'm sure that this encyclical will have a profound impact in the discussions of climate change.
The release of the encyclical is coming in a critical year for climate negotiations, which will culminate in December with a new United Nations Treaty on Global Warming. Leading up to that meeting, Pope Francis will speak at a joint session of the U.S. Congress and at the United Nations. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Also in the news, militants from the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram have killed at least 38, happened in a raid in two villages in Niger's Diffa region, close to the border with Nigeria. Attacks mark the latest attempt by the Nigeria-based Boko Haram to strike inside neighboring countries that had joined the Nigerian military's attempt to quash the group. Earlier this week, authorities in Chad blamed the group for two suicide bombings in the capital and left at least 33 people dead. Chad, along with Niger and Cameroon, deployed troops earlier this year to fight Boko Haram after the militants launched a series of cross-border attacks. UNICEF says at least 129 children were killed during a government offensive against rebel forces in South Sudan last month. UNICEF's executive director, Anthony Lake, says survivors reported that the boys were castrated and left to bleed to death, while girls as young as 8 were gang-raped and killed. He says other children were reportedly thrown into burning buildings. South Sudan has been fighting rebels led by the former deputy president since December of 2013, when a split among the armed forces in the capital, Juba, later escalated into bloody violence across the country. UNICEF estimates some 13,000 children have been forced to participate in the conflict. Associated Press is reporting that investigators who collected DNA from the tusk of slain elephants and looked for matches across Africa have identified two large areas where the slaughter has been occurring on an industrial scale. The two areas are Tanzania in the east and a cross-border region encompassing several nations in the central western part of Africa. Samuel Wasser, an author of the study published in the journal Science, said he hopes the study will focus law enforcement efforts and increase international pressure on host countries to crack down on poaching. Still ahead on VOA, a revolutionary song from the 1960s.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of new studies says that we humans are using a lot of water and are quickly draining some of the largest groundwater basins around the world. Especially concerning, the amount of water that does remain is unknown due to a lack of data. The aquifers scientists are most concerned about happen to be located in the world's driest areas, where people rely heavily on underground water. This includes the Arabian Aquifer system in the Middle East and the Indus Basin Aquifer of northwestern India and Pakistan. Factors such as climate change, along with a growing population, are expected to deepen the problem. Researchers made this determination by analyzing information gathered by NASA's Twin Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment satellites. The satellites gauge the water loss by measuring variations in Earth's gravity, which scientists say is affected by the weight of water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. And it's time now for a little something from the VOA Music Department. Here's David Byrd.
If you remember 1965, you'll remember that the United States had just started sending land troops to a place called Vietnam. Lyndon Baines Johnson was president, and in music, the British invasion, topped by the Beatles, the four lads from Liverpool, had happened just a year before. But that was also the year that a landmark song by Bob Dylan was put out. Ray McDonald joins me here in the studio to talk about Like a Rolling Stone. Ray, why was Like a Rolling Stone so revolutionary?
It broke all the rules. To begin with, the song was over 6 minutes long, and it went immediately to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart. That in itself was unheard of. Most singles were 2 and 3 minutes long, and Columbia Records originally split it over two sides of a 45, but the fans insisted on hearing the song itself. Dylan was a folk musician. He was not considered an electric musician, but this song turned him into a rock star, and it put him toe-to-toe with acts like the Beatles. In fact, the Beatles kept him out of number one. Help was at the top the week that Like a Rolling Stone came onto the charts. The lyrics were freeform. They were poetic. They were taken from a long poem that Dylan had written while he was on tour the month before. And the whole thing just seemed perfect for its time.
Dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Didn't you? People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you.
How does this compare to some of other Dylan songs, like The Times They Are a-Changing?
Well, I mean, Dylan got he made his bones, he made his fame as a protest musician, as a folk musician who initially adapted the folk songs of Woody Guthrie and other folk musicians. He came out of the Greenwich Village folk scene, and as such, he was a bit of a niche performer. Like a Rolling Stone, really thrust him into the rock mainstream, and it influenced an entire generation of rock artists. Paul McCartney remembers listening to the song with John Lennon and saying, well, it just seemed to go on forever and it opened new possibilities for us. Bruce Springsteen talks about how that opening snare drum was like kicking a door open in his mind. So he really set the template for artistic creativity within a hard rock setting.
Now, this song came out right before Bob Dylan kind of upset his fan base, all those folk listeners, by going electric. What exactly did this have to do with that?
Like a Rolling Stone hit the shelves on July 20th, 1965, and that was just a few days before Dylan and his band made their famous electric appearance at the Newport, Rhode Island Folk Festival. And that was really Dylan's coming out party for his rock phase. And it upset a lot of his more traditional fans, but it gained him an incredible new audience.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You can hit him up at VOA_music on Twitter. You can also go on to our webpage, that's voanews.com. You can hear Ray count down the top 20 songs of the week and the top 5 songs of the week.
And you know, even today, Bob Dylan's still finding fans out there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to The Voice of America and for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The question is not whether the Earth's climate is changing, but how are we going to adjust to the effects of climate change? Climate change poses a threat to every country on Earth, and we all need to do what we can to take advantage of the small window of opportunity we still have to stave off its worst, most disastrous impacts, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent statement. But even as we take unprecedented steps to mitigate the climate threat, we also have to ensure our communities are prepared for the impacts we know are headed our way. Located at the end of the Ganges and Brahmaputra drainage basins, and with much of its area comprised of low-lying coastal plains, Bangladesh has a long history of disastrous flooding. At about 1,000 people per square kilometer, it has the world's highest population density per square kilometer. Moreover, 80% of the country's population depends on agriculture as a source of income. All of these factors combine to make Bangladesh one of the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. This is expected to worsen as climate change exacerbates extreme weather events, such as monsoon rains and cyclones, and as sea levels rise with the melting of the ice caps. Some experts estimate that Bangladesh could lose 2 to 3% of GDP growth due to the effects of climate change. Bangladesh must prepare for the changes, but as a developing country with about half of its population living in poverty, it is finding the going difficult. That is why Bangladesh is one of the 3 countries, along with Colombia and Ethiopia, targeted for climate readiness assistance in the first phase of President Barack Obama's new Climate Services for Resilient Development initiative. This international public-private partnership will work with developing nations to help them boost their own climate resilience by providing them with science relevant to their situation, information, useful tools, and training. The initiative will concentrate on adaptation to changing conditions. And as the program matures, more countries will be invited to participate. When it comes to confronting climate change, no country should be forced to go it alone, because no country can possibly address this threat alone, said Secretary of State Kerry. It will require all of us, every country around the world, doing what it can to contribute to the solution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.